triumphal entry in Luke, which is in Luke 19, verses 28 to 44. After he had said these things, he was going on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. And when he approached Bethphage and Bethany near the mount that is called Olivet, he sent two of his disciples, saying, "Go into the village ahead of you, and as you enter, you will find a colt tied on which no one yet has ever sat. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' you shall say, 'The Lord has need of it.'" Can you imagine going and getting someone's horse today and telling them the Lord has need of it? So those who were sent went away and found it just as he has told them. And as they were untying the colt, its owner said to them, "Why are you untying the colt?" They said, "The Lord has need of it." They brought it to Jesus, and they threw their coats on the colt, put Jesus on it. And as he was going, they were spreading their coats on the road. And as soon as he was approaching near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of the disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the miracles which they had seen, shouting, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." But Jesus answered, "I tell you, if these become silent, the stones will cry out." And when he approached Jerusalem, he saw the city and he wept over it, saying, "If you had known in this day, even you, the things which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side. And they will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation." The practice of spreading things, you still see them spreading flower petals and sometimes put some kind of a special floor covering out for bride and groom, specifically when the bride comes up the aisle. But the idea of doing that, of making the path nice for someone of great importance, was very traditional at the time. And so we're going to look at this meaning of Palm Sunday, and I want to look what it meant to various groups. As you go up over the Mount of Olives today, you get a look at the Holy City. The spire you see there is the Muslim Dome of the Rock, but you would have seen the temple. The gate you see there was closed up, I think, by Suleiman the Magnificent, because there is a persistent saying and legend that when Jesus returns, he's going to come through the Eastern Gate, very possibly from the passages in Zechariah. And so the Muslims closed up the gate and planted a cemetery in front of it, presuming that a Jewish rabbi would never go through a cemetery because he would be rendered defiled by that. I hope I live long enough to see all that prove to be foolishness. But one never knows. But that is the Eastern Gate as of March of 2019. And so picture him coming down the descent. He's up over the top of Olivet, and the city is out ahead of him. That gate is open with pilgrims going in and out, and where you see a glimpse of the Dome of the Rock, you would have seen the temple, Herod's temple rising, which was supposed to be one of the marvels of the ancient world, and for its magnificence. And so, the triumphal entry, and like very many events, it meant different things to different people. Okay? So, if you look at a bill in Congress, look at the Keystone pipeline. Trump said yes, Biden says no. Okay? And so there's environmental group says, no, 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 we don't want to ever use any more oil. And then we have petroleum groups that say, yes, 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 we're going to make some good money out of this and provide a lot of jobs. And so the rich man is interested in enhancing what he has. The poor man would just like to get a job and be able to put food on the table. The environmentalist is stewing lest you cut down a single tree. And we see that different people have different lenses that they look through. Okay? And the lens is generally called self-interest. How will this affect me and mine? What is it going to do for me? How is it going to damage me? And so people can look at the identical same event and see totally different things. That's the human condition. And so I'd like to start with the religious leaders of the time. They're called the Sanhedrin. They're called the scribes, Pharisees, elders. You see all those terms in the New Testament. Sadducees as well. And these were the authorities that were recognized by the Roman government. They had a certain amount of autonomy and a certain amount of wiggle room where they could do something. They had the temple tax money that came to them. They had dominion over religious thought and practice. They also could levy minor punishments, not capital punishments. And so if there was a revolution, if there was upheaval of some kind, they were the ones with the most to lose. And so they didn't like living under Roman domination, but at the same time, they were the group that was getting the most out of it. Rome was just interested in getting tribute, their taxes from the territories under their control, and relative peace. If we've learned anything in Afghanistan, we've learned that it's expensive to keep an army going for years on end. And Rome had the same problem. It costs a lot of money if they had to send an army out. They would prefer not to have to do that. And so we see the religious leaders were invested in keeping things just as they were. And, you know, there's an old saying, better the devil you know than the devil you don't know. Well, to them, they had learned how to deal with Rome, and they didn't want anyone upsetting the apple cart. Now, these people were the drivers of subsequent events. Without them, nothing would have happened as it happened. And so, we need to look at them. We need to look at this group. They were very zealous, and they were very religious in their own way. And they kept a multitude of traditions that had been handed down from various rabbis. Although if you study them carefully, even though they claim they came from Moses, a lot of them had Babylonian roots out of the Babylonian captivity, but I digress. And there was prominent rabbis. You have Hillel on the liberal side, Shammai on the conservative side, and they had whole schools of thought and disciples who followed them, just like the disciples followed Jesus. They were very well known. And they were educated. These were not ignorant men. They knew the questions of the day. They knew the Hillel position, the Shammai position, and the various rabbis, and they could discuss that intelligently. But their knowledge tend to make them arrogant. If you look in chapter 13 in Corinthians, where it talks about love, Paul says, now don't be puffed up because you have knowledge. But that isn't going to help you love your neighbor. And we can see the same trend in this country to this day. A lot of our leaders are very elitist. And they look down on you and I, and they say, well, they're really too dumb to do what's good for them, so we're going to make them do what's good for them. You know, enough with this concept of freedom that they can do what they want. So if we look at John 7, 48 to 49, and here's a direct quote, no one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But this multitude who does not know the law is accursed. And this is the answer when they sent the temple police to seize Jesus. And they go in and he's teaching in the temple and they stand there and they listen to him. And they turn right around and they go back. They say, why didn't you bring him? They said, no man ever spake like this man speaks. We heard him. They said, well, you're not being led astray too. I mean, don't confuse us with how this man teaches, because our minds are already made up. So as we look at this whole class, they were very invested in their tradition, very invested in the rules and things they had handed down from the elders. And they were protective of their own station, their own authority and power. They didn't want change. That was seen as non-negotiable in their eyes. And that's a human attribute. And you can even see that in the church. Perhaps someone's done something for 10, 15, 20 years, whatever, and you might get a newcomer saying, well, couldn't we change and do this a different way? Change! Are you crazy? And that's right in our own number. But people are resistant to change. They're resistant to doing something a different way. And they're very resistant if there's any hint that they might have been wrong. So the teaching and the signs that Jesus did, they were seen as a direct threat. So remember now with a triumphal entry, if you turn to John chapter 11, you get a little different snapshot, and this is very germane because this is the chapter about Lazarus getting sick and dying. And so we have to remember that Bethany is only 2 miles away from Jerusalem, which means the news of something, it's like Olean and Allegheny, you know? If something happens in Allegheny, not too long before you're going to know about an Olean. And so we know that whatever happened in Bethany would soon be the talk of Jerusalem. Hey, did you hear what happened in Bethany? This guy Jesus, his friend Lazarus died, and he came and had him roll the stone away. They called him. He called him right out of the grave. He came out in grave clothes. He'd been dead 4 days. This has got to be the Messiah. Who else but the Messiah could do this? It was a very public miracle. People were there mourning and supporting the sisters, just like some of the funerals we've had recently here in the church. calling a man out of the tomb was a notable miracle. I'd like to see something like that. So here also was Lazarus living in Bethany, and he was a constant testimonial. There he is. You don't think it happened? There he is. You can talk to him. And so in John 11:47-48, and that's what I want to highlight here, because this bears on the attitude. I'm going to start in 45. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. Now, what would be your reaction if you saw something like that? But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Therefore, the chief priests and Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." So the conclusion of the council is they're going to have to get him out of the way. Going to have to get him out of the way. So now that we've kind of set the scene, Jesus comes into Jerusalem riding on a young donkey and comes over the top of Olivet. And people are spreading garments in the way. The Luke portion doesn't mention leafy branches, but parallel passages mention leafy branches they cut out in the fields and they spread in the way. And so we get Palm Sunday. And the crowds were saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." Now, this comes from Psalm 118, verse 26. And interestingly, that psalm also contains a verse about the stone that was rejected by the builders, which has become the chief cornerstone, doing of the Lord, which is marvelous in our eyes. But now we have to turn to Zechariah 9:9. "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey." Now you get the Pharisees complaining in the crowd, and, you know, they opposed Jesus, so sometimes we look down on them. But let me tell you something. They had these verses memorized. When he's coming in on a donkey and the people are shouting, their mind is going to this psalm that they probably sang different times. And they're alarmed at what? The symbolism. Because what can this be otherwise than a claim to be the king? So they wanted this stopped. What are we doing? He's making a public claim by what the disciples are shouting to being a king. And not only that, but what he just did over in Bethany, the whole town is buzzing with it. Of course, the town is stuffed with pilgrims because this is one of the festivals where every Jewish male was supposed to come. For this reason, they say, "Tell your disciples not to shout like this." His answer is instructive. "I tell you, if these hold their peace, the very stones will cry out." Well, since we've already said our Pharisees know the scripture, We're going to turn to Isaiah 55:12, which says the mountains and hills will break forth into shouts, and all the trees of the field will clap their hands. So this reply just makes them more concerned than ever. What is this man going to do? They're more determined than ever. We have to put a stop to this. Now, the religious authorities and their reaction is a little depressing. So let's turn to the disciples. So if we look at the account of Lazarus being brought out of the grave, some of that crowd of people that were out there shouting must have also been at the gravesite. We know the disciples were there. We don't know how many others were there. But here he comes into Jerusalem, and having seen this fabulous miracle, they're shouting. If he can do that, what else can he do? What else will he do? Would this man restore the kingdom in the same miraculous manner that he called someone out of the grave? Will he take the throne of David immediately? So, for them, they're almost delirious with joy. Some of them have been with him 3 years. They watched the teaching. They've seen the miracles. To them, this is the culmination. What's going to happen? Maybe the restoration of the kingdom of Israel. And so, especially for the disciples, this is just one more of a string of miracles they had seen. And even getting the colt was a slice. I was raised in the country, and if you get on a colt or get on a calf that's never been ridden, let me tell you, exciting times are at hand. And you won't be sitting there very long. You're going to be in the dirt. And here's Jesus riding on this colt that's never been ridden, and the colt is perfectly docile. When told that the Lord had need of it, the owner let it go. Now, as they came up over the mountain, the city comes in view, the eastern gate that you see now. They have not excavated below the eastern gate to find the original eastern gate, although they believe it's there. This was a gate that came into existence like after the Crusaders or during the time of the Crusades, but there's a lot of religious sensibilities and difficulties about doing any kind of an excavation in East Jerusalem that's claimed by both the Palestinians and the Jews. So they have let that alone. But I believe that underneath this gate, you're going to find the remains of the eastern gate that was there at the time of Christ. And so the Messiah then was the son of David, and he was going to come and sit on the throne of David. And so it was a time of tremendous expectations. Now, if any of you are literary, Charles Dickens wrote a book entitled Great Expectations, and it was about a young boy that had all kinds of expectations of what he was going to do and be in his lifetime, and then the book kind of lays out where he actually goes. And needless to say, his actual life differed from his expectations. And I think if we can look back to when we were much younger, most of us can truthfully say our actual life was quite different from our expectations. I know mine was. And if you go to Luke 19, 11 through 27, it says that the disciples supposed that the kingdom of God would appear immediately. And he's telling them a parable to kind of back them up. And you can see it by the shouting during the triumphal entry. You know, we think it's going to appear right now. Jesus was trying to explain to them that, listen, boys, this is not a 100-yard dash. You're looking at a marathon here. It's not exactly what you think it is. But the disciples still had those expectations. And I know they still had the expectations because after the resurrection, when they saw Jesus, what was it they said to him? Will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? And he said, it's not for you to know the times and the epochs that the Father has fixed by his own authority. I have a job for you. I want you to go make disciples and testify about me in Judea and Samaria and out to the uttermost parts of the world. That's what you need to know. That's all you need to know. And so we see on the one side dread and fear by the religious authorities, and we see on the other side joy and expectation from the disciples. They were looking for something really big. Now, what did the triumphal entry mean to Jesus? If we look at verses 41 to 44 in Luke, we can see that to Jesus, he's mourning. Okay? He's mourning because he's looking into the future and seeing what's going to happen. And he doesn't want that. The disciples were shouting for joy as they came in sight of the eastern gate. But Jesus knew what they didn't know, or what they didn't want to know, or what they didn't want to acknowledge. Because it was very clear at that particular point that the religious authorities were not going to accept him. And the reminder was the Pharisees telling him, tell your disciples not to say that. And in verse 41, it says he's weeping over the city. They're rejoicing. He's weeping. And here again, we see what we talked about at the very beginning of the message. People see events through the lens of their own knowledge, their own experience, and their own values. And so on the one hand, we see the religious authorities dreading this man claiming to be the Messiah. On the other hand, we see the disciples rejoicing and ecstatic with joy because they're looking for the restoration of the kingdom. They're looking for the kingdom of heaven. And we see Jesus weeping. Three very different emotional reactions, and he's weeping. And he said, if you had known in this day, that's the day of the triumphal entry, even you, the things which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes. For For the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side. They will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. He's looking forward roughly 40 years to the siege of Jerusalem. And he knows what's going to happen. Because the religious authorities, rather than accepting him and going with it, are going to use all their power, all their authority, all their influence with the Roman government to keep the common people from accepting him as the Messiah. They're going to conspire with Rome to do away with him as a threat to their power and authority. And because of their unbelief, because of their rebellion against God, they would be punished. But they wouldn't be the only ones punished. They wouldn't be punished alone. The common people who had no part in that decision to reject him would also be punished. And the nation would be punished. Jerusalem would be leveled to the ground. And Josephus, in his Jewish history, talks about 500 people being crucified every day. He talks about people being killed. He talks about people being hauled away into slavery at the siege of Jerusalem. The Roman armies let the people come in for Passover, because guess what? It was Passover time yet again. But they wouldn't let them come out. And there wasn't enough food in the city to sustain that kind of people. When the people ran out to try to get food, the Romans caught them and crucified them. It was a terrible time. This is parallel punishment to the Babylonian captivity. Actually, there's a day of mourning on the Jewish calendar to this day for the fall of Jerusalem, which, by the way, Passover was at sundown yesterday. The nation did not heed the warning of the parable of the vineyard. Remember the parable where the people that rented the vineyard wouldn't give the fruits to the master? Jesus said, those tenants are going to be thrown out and brought to a wretched end. And the vineyard will be let out to people that will render fruit in the season. So as the elite religious leaders are conspiring to kill him, we get an insight into the character of Jesus, one of many. He is not angry so much at the religious leaders as he is mourning their lack of leadership, their lack of vision, their faulty leadership, if you will, is leading the nation into disaster. The last group that we should consider is this group. What does this text mean to us? We can truly call Jesus the King who comes in the name of the Lord. That's correct. It's factual. And so, in John 10, 17 and 18, we read, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me. I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This command I receive from my Father." Now, this makes it clear that the sacrifice of Jesus 1 week later was not the result of the soldiers taking him, but rather was the result of him laying down his life. He had the authority to lay his life down. And he took it up again with the resurrection. So as we consider this passage, there's a number of things to think about. The triumphal entry, the cleansing of the temple, the subsequent events were not the product of random chance. They were elements in a plan. The Messiah came to the Jews and proclaimed the kingdom of God for roughly 3 years. Now, Paul said the gospel came what? To the Jew first, and also to the Greek. Many Jews did believe, because we need to remember that in that group shouting at the triumphal entry, they were all Jews. There's no record that there was any Gentiles in the bunch. Paul said that the rejection from the Jewish nation meant riches for the Gentiles. The ministry to the Gentiles, of course, came after the resurrection. That's us. And so the foundation was built there with Jesus and the disciples. We're still building on it. We're still building on it to this day. And so I think we should keep in mind all these things as we move into next week. Next week, I'm going to endeavor to show you how the plan changed, because we know in the Matthew portion it said, not during the festival, lest there be a riot among the people. But that's exactly what did happen. So the question immediately coming to mind is, how did they get from here to there? We're going to explore that next week. But we're closing with hymn number 198.